Hey, y'all. Thanks for listening to Killer Queens.
Or KQ if you're nasty.
Welcome to the show where two 90s loving country chicks gab about true crime and tell each other to talk to the hand because the face ain't listening. I'm Torella.
And I'm Tori.
And we're sisters who have always loved true crime and decided to turn that obsession into a show with a light take on the topic.
Kind of like diet true crime, it's all the flavor and fewer calories.
Now with our show, you'll get true crime, 90s nostalgia, and a few four-letter words sprinkled in.
Because I always say that Polly Pockets and true crime go together like peas and carrots.
Be sure to check out our case submission form on our website at killerqueenspodcast.com and follow us on social media and YouTube.
Now grab your Surge, your 3D Cool Ranch Doritos, and your kitten surprise, and let's get into the episode.
This episode contains discussion of abduction, kidnapping, torture, dismemberment, murder with a weapon, knife, and gun, rape, animal cruelty, racism, and necrophilia, and big fat dipshit. Listener discretion is advised.
Serving as the sheriff's deputy in Martin County, Florida, Gerard Schaefer led a double life, portraying himself as a dedicated officer while secretly engaging in gruesome acts. Schaefer was convicted of the first-degree murders of two young women, Susan Place and Georgia Jessup. Investigators suspect that Schaefer was responsible for as many as 30 murders from the late 60s to the early 70s before his arrest and eventual conviction. During his incarceration, Schaefer penned short stories depicting the abduction and murder of women, some of which contained chilling details correlating with women who had been reported missing or bodies that had been found, adding a disturbing layer to the already gruesome nature of his crimes.
Hey, you guys, welcome to Killer Queens. If you've never been here before, we want to give you just a little information about how the show is set up and what it's meant to accomplish. If you have been here before, welcome back. You can just use that handy skip ahead feature here if you want to.
We want to give a message to friends and family of the victims. We know that there may be someone involved in the case who might listen one day, and we want you to know that our intention is to only bring awareness to this case. And while we do use personal stories in some instances and our own humor in order to tell the story in a way that listeners can relate, we have the utmost respect for victims and their families.
We created Killer Queens to be a place where we can have open discussions about cases just like you would with friends. We are not investigators. We use information that is available to the public, such as documentaries, case files, and media coverage. Using this information, we intend to tell the story of what happened in each case that we cover. Now, will you agree with our interpretations or conclusions of each case? Well, heck no.
We each approach cases from different perspectives, life experiences, and beliefs that we already have in place. And sometimes these differences are slight, yet they can be wide enough to cause divide and upset some of those listening. We do our best to present the facts as we find them in our research, but we do bring our own perspectives to the case. We understand that you will too. We want you to know that this is a safe space to discuss differences and opinions in a civilized manner. Our style may not be your personal preference, and if that's the case, we know you'll be able to find one of the many other shows out there to tell the story the way you want to hear it. We can be grown-ups about it if you can.
Now, if we are your cup of tea and you want even more KQ, you can join our Patreon and get access to our entire catalog of episodes ad-free and access to bonus episodes too. And I'll give you just a little hint if you're an ad skipper, but you still want the deals that we have from our sponsors each week, you can scroll down to the show notes and see what coupons we have available for you right down there.
But you didn't hear it from us.
That's a pro tip, but I'll deny ever sharing it.
Right. So all that being said, let's get into the story.
Okay.
Grody to the max.
Yeah, you can't see how much we are rolling our eyes. This guy, you want to talk about a window open scale? You are going to be so... I don't even know the word.
You're going to be like super open.
I mean, like, I feel the opposite of scrumptralescent.
Yes.
I don't know what that word is. I don't know what it would be, but like, so angry, you're going to throw yourself out the window.
Mm-hmm.
Nothing is safe.
No.
Like, scorched earth. Okay.
Yes. The flames.
This guy. Yeah, exactly. We do have a couple thank yous, though, before we get started. This was requested by Amber Judd and Cree W. So thank you for that.
Thank you. And thank you to Mark for writing it up.
Thank you. All right. So we're going to start out by saying right away, this is one of those cases that unfortunately there's just more information about the perpetrator than there are the victims. That is one of the really unfortunate truths, I guess, about covering a serial killer. So we're not going to have nearly as much information about the victims, unfortunately. Gerard Schaefer is sometimes referred to as Florida's first serial killer or the killer cop. While he was convicted of two murders, there's no doubt that he's responsible for many more. He has confessed during his incarceration, but at some points his confessions kind of start to feel like a Henry Lee Lucas, like the confession killer sort of situation. From the day he was arrested, Schaefer always publicly denied all charges against him. If you see him in the media at all, he's going to say, I'm totally innocent. Nothing has anything to do with me. There's no evidence. But privately, he confessed to multiple murders of girls and young women. So let's start with his childhood, how he grew up. Gerard Schaefer was born in Neenah, Wisconsin in March of 1946. And Neenah is like, it's not too big. It's not too small. Okay.
Just the right size.
It's just the right size. It's a town along the coast of Lake Winnebago with a population of around 27,000, according to the 2020 census. Looking at the history of the town, there's nothing major that sticks out that really sets it apart from any other small towns, other than the fact that Kimberly Clark was founded there. Kimberly Clark is a corporation that sells paper-based consumer products, sanitary paper products, and surgical and medical instruments. Kleenex, Kotex, Cottonelle, Scott, Huggies diapers, and wipes. They're like the bathroom paper products giant. They're like the butt wiping
kings,
bosses.
Yeah.
Like, and I know I recognized Kimberly Clark because, like, if you go to the doctor or whatever, you know, they have those like things on the wall where you can pull out the paper towels, but they're always like they look a certain way or like in a bathroom.
Yeah.
Like, those are always like, a lot of times, Kimberly Clark. I know there's other brands.
I never noticed that. Well, now you've shattered the glass for me, but Kimberly Clark, I was like, never heard of her. Don't know who she is.
She's a butt wiping boss babe.
Good for her.
I know. Good for her. With many of the stories we do when it comes to a small town like this, it's fun to look at other people who come from the area. And when looking into Neenah, there are a few athletes that have played in the NFL, NBA, or MLB, but there's a lot of politicians that have come out of this area. Just for a really, like, again, it's not too small. It's not as small as your mama's Jack Russell.
Not really, no.
But it's not too big either. You know what I mean? It's like,
it's a Goldilocks town. You know what I mean?
Yeah. And like a lot of politicians have come out of there. Are they putting something in the cheddar? We don't know. We don't know. Thanks for that one, Mark. Okay, so back to Schaefer. He was the first of three children born to, you guessed it, Gerard Sr., because I'd like to do a poll. Like, how many serial killers are juniors?
Yeah, I don't know. That would be
or
nice
the thirds
to know.
Or whatever. I feel like they're always named directly after their father. Like,
yes.
I know a lot of other people are too. I'm just saying, like, seems to be a trend here.
Part
and
of the McDonald's triad,
Doris.
Right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, this is like the 57th.
Leg of the McDonald triad.
Exactly. His father was a traveling salesman. His mother was a homemaker. And early on, they ended up moving to Nashville, Tennessee, where Schaefer was raised before they relocated to Atlanta, Georgia. They spent some time there, and then they ended up moving again to Fort Lauderdale, Florida.
I'm glad that they didn't stay in Nashville very long. Like, go on, get.
I know, get. Moving to Florida in 1960 seemed to be the permanent move the family was looking for because that's where they ended up staying. And Schaefer would later say his childhood was, quote, troubled and turbulent because of all the moves. He also said, my childhood was great. It was totally normal. Nothing wrong with it. I watched this like long ass interview with him. And they even like, y'all want to talk about somebody who can fucking talk? My God. He's like going on. And they would do that thing where they would just like fade out what he's saying and lay on to. And it would, that interview, it was an hour long that I watched. And it probably was in all actuality, like 4 hours long. And they just
100%.
Cut a bunch of parts out of it. I mean,
yeah.
It was
that
insane.
Bitch can bloviate.
Holy moly. And like, and he literally is like, he says, I had a great childhood. There were no problems. My parents didn't beat me. I didn't have any problems. Okay, so just
keep in mind, he has said that.
Keep that in mind. Yeah. Also, though, his father was an alcoholic who verbally abused his wife and children. I don't know why he goes back and forth with that. Like, he must just be trying to distance himself from it all the way around, I guess. But like, no, we didn't have any. I have no idea. So remember, his dad was a traveling salesman, so he was gone a lot. But when he was there, his relationship with his eldest son, this guy, okay, was described as difficult. Gerard Jr. resented his father because of the constant belittling, and he thought that his dad favored his sister over him. He was very close with his mother, though, and she was extremely protective of all of her children. So growing up in Florida, an outdoor paradise to many people, Schaefer himself became an avid outdoor enthusiast, and he liked to collect guns, go hunting, he liked going fishing. On some occasions when their relationship was in a good place, he and his father would spend time together hunting and fishing, but it never lasted, and their relationship would always kind of go back to a negative place. In school, his classmates said that he wasn't really a member of any particular group or clique. He was more of a loner who preferred to take part in his interests alone. Almost everyone looked at him as an outdoorsman who would, like, they thought he was going to be like a forest ranger or something. Like, his superlative would have been most likely to be outdoorsy.
Right. Most likely to prevent forest fires.
Exactly. By the time he was a teenager, he had begun to develop erotic fantasies about women he deemed, quote, worthy of his contempt.
Huh.
Would we say that's a... I don't know about that. Okay.
I don't like it.
I know.
Hey, KQ listeners. This episode is proudly brought to you by LolaVie, an award-winning hair care line founded by the fabulous Jennifer Aniston. And we all know the only thing more beautiful than Jen Ann herself, it's not a little tulip nose, it's her gorgeous hair. And listen, we all put our hair through a lot. We color it, we style it with hot tools, we put it up with rubber bands. Don't do that. But also stress and aging take a toll too. And honestly, Jen got tired of the damage and the struggle of having to choose between hair products that work and ones that are actually good for us. So instead of mixing this cream with that serum, she decided to bottle something of her very own by diving into the science of it all while using naturally derived plant-based ingredients. And not only did she make something that works and is good for you, but it also smells amazing. Seriously, one of my favorite scents ever. If it was a perfume, I would totally wear it. And it seriously works. Like, I do not like to wash my hair. In fact, it's up there for me with grocery shopping. I mean, I don't want to be dramatic, but I'd rather die. But this was before LolaVie. I find myself washing it more and more because of the scent, the softness, and the products. And here's a treat for you. Our awesome listeners, for a limited time, you get an exclusive 15% off your entire order at LolaVie.com. Just use code QUEENS at checkout. I mean, if you're taking hair care advice, why listen to anyone besides the woman who gave us the Rachel? Unlock Jennifer Aniston's approved hair at LolaVie.com. As our loyal listeners, you'll get an exclusive 15% off your entire order when you use code QUEENS at checkout. That's 15% off your order at LolaVie, LolaVie.com with promo code QUEENS. Please note, you can only use one promo code per order and discounts can't be combined. After you purchase, they'll ask where you heard about them. Please support our show and tell them that we sent you. Your hair will thank you. Again, unlock Jennifer Aniston approved hair at LolaVie.com. As our loyal listeners, you'll get an exclusive 15% off your entire order when you use code QUEENS at checkout. That's 15% off your order at LolaVie.com with promo code QUEENS. Please note that you can only use one promo code per order and discounts can't be combined. After you purchase, they'll ask where you heard about them. Please support our show and tell them we sent you and your hair will thank you.
He leaned into sadomasochism and bondage fantasies and found pleasure in causing pain to himself. He admitted to wearing women's underwear and later cross-dressing, his words, when he was a teenager and to taking part in autoerotic asphyxiation. His actions escalated to the point where he would find a rural area with no one around. He'd tie himself to a tree, and then he would do the things he wanted to do. Gradually, these thoughts took over and became almost literally the only thing that he would think about during the day.
I feel like
all he could think about.
It's very Korn of him. Adidas, all day I dream about sex.
Oh, yeah.
Except for Korn. I feel bad for Korn to even put them in that same sentence even, but also autoerotic asphyxiation. The word autoerotic reminds me of Jurassic Park when the lawyer is like, are these autoerotica? And then Mr. Oh my God, why can't I think of his name? John Hammond. Is it Hammond? He's like, no, yes. Everything at Jurassic Park is completely real. Anyway, that's where my mind went.
Yes. And I know that like young boys think about sex on a very regular basis.
And I'm sure young girls sometimes do too.
Never.
Oh.
Yeah, girls also don't fart. I don't know if you knew that.
Okay. I might be broken.
I'm sure you wondered why you've never farted. Oh, okay. But the way that he's thinking about it is he's associating it with pain.
Well, and worthy of his contempt. I'm like,
worthy. I don't like that word. And then contempt. It's like
it's all bad.
Like it'd be bad enough if he was like, girls worthy of my attention.
Or affection even.
Uh-huh. But his contempt, it's like a problem wrapped up in another problem. You know what I mean?
Yes. And then tied up with a little disgusting bow.
Exactly. In his high school years, he dated here and there. But for the most part, the girls who attended the school was not having it. Okay. Mm-hmm. So by this time, he was also a bit of a peeping Tom. Okay. A woman who attended school with him said, quote, I can't remember him being friends with any of the guys. He was always on the outside looking in. As a matter of fact, the only thing I really remember is that I always had to tuck my skirt under my legs because he would practically stand on his head to look up a girl's skirt.
I think another that's bad.
Thing, yeah. I know, yeah. Another thing he said in that interview was,
I can't believe you sat through the entire thing.
I know. It was tough. I did have to speed it up because my God. But another thing he said in the interview was, oh yeah, there was this girl that lived in our neighborhood. She was not a good Catholic girl because he went to a Catholic school. And he's like, you know, she was just raised in a different system. She wasn't Catholic. So like, whatever. And he's like, but every night at 10 o'clock, she would change her clothes in front of her window on purpose for us to watch her. So she'd stand in front of her window and do this strip tease. And I thought that was kind of, you know, slutty. But she wanted to do it. She wanted us to look. So he's like, me and the guys, you know, it's always a group thing. We're always in groups. We're hanging out in groups or whatever. So we'd be at whoever's house. And then we'd be like, oh, it's 10 o'clock. It's about time for, he says her first and last name. I don't remember what it was now. And I wouldn't say it even if he did. But I'm like, are you really going to
blame her? Obviously.
Like blast somebody's first and last name that you, mm-hmm. anyway. So he's like, oh yeah, we'd all look at each other and be like, oh guys, it's about 10 o'clock. Time for her to do her striptease in front of the window. And we'd all go out to the yard and watch her. He didn't have friends.
Like, right. Yeah. Who was going
with him? You know, who were these groups of guys that he was hanging out with all the time? Because everybody that knew him said he didn't really have any friends. He wasn't doing.
Right. It's like old school when Frank the Tank is like, come on, guys, we're going streaking. And he's the only one streaking and he thinks everybody's behind him.
Yeah.
But they're not.
Yeah. Like, and it fits more with, because he will try to, he'll talk you in circles until you are so
exhausted.
Like, you know what? Just fine. Fuck it. Whatever you say, just make it stop. Right. So like, but this fits more with the peeping Tom situation, which he of course says is absolutely false. Everything that's ever been said about him is incorrect, by the way, just in case you're wondering.
I mean, I think that everybody, because sometimes you get undressed or you change into your night gowns or whatever you wear to bed. I don't think I've ever had a nightgown, to be honest. Maybe I did, like a Barbie one. But anyway, you change into your night clothes and you don't even think about sometimes, you know, you're like, I've done it before where I'm like, oh shit, my blinds were open, mm-hmm. you know?
Yeah.
Right, it wasn't for anybody's benefit, you know, like I wasn't like,
right.
Exactly.
And he's acting like, yeah, this is like a fucking boudoir show.
Like a peep show.
Yeah. Just for him that like this girl that lives in their neighborhood is like, I know I'll give all the boys a show. And if she wants to, fine, like right. Go for it. I don't care. I just don't believe that that's what was happening.
No.
It's highly unlikely, especially considering that he was peeping in windows already. He's trying to get upskirts and like, I don't think so.
Again, that reminds me, my mind always goes, you know this by now if you've been listening to our show. It's always movies, music, or TV shows. It's like media always. But I'm thinking Grease, remember when they would like get underneath the bleachers and look up their skirts? And it's like, oh, boys will be boys.
Boys will be boys. Oh, my God. That I used to love that movie. And like as an adult now, I'm like, oh, my God. Also, I did not realize what the words to Grease Lightning meant. Oh, my God.
And we
I heard it again. And I was like, I sang that with my little baby mouth. Ew.
The Blech. Chicks. Anyway. It's supreme. No, the chicks
yeah.
will.
Mm-hmm, yep. Yep. Mm-hmm, yep. Mm-hmm, yep. Teachers all said that Schaefer was an excellent student. He was a member of the varsity football team. He was known to be an excellent golfer. After he graduated high school, he worked briefly as a fishing guide before applying to St. John's Seminary to try to join the priesthood. He was rejected, though, because they felt he did not have enough faith. Essentially, they didn't believe that his heart aligned with the priesthood. Which is true. He was trying to join the priesthood because he, at one point, he knew that the way that he felt about women was going to lead him down a bad path. And he at this point, seemed to genuinely want to change that. He thought, I can't control my urges on my own, so if I join the priesthood, I'll have to.
Right.
And they were like, something right here.
Yeah, we don't want you.
I don't even wanna. And, you know, some could say that there are some questionable characters in the priesthood that make it through. So yeah. GJ had to be pretty fucking bad, if you ask me. He had been a practicing Catholic. He had attended years of daily mass. But after this rejection, he decided that he had been under some kind of like Catholic mind control thing. And so he abandoned the church. So like, you're lost. Can't believe you would do this to me.
Well, and also it's like, it's somebody else's fault, right? Like he couldn't possibly be him that for the reason for the rejection, right? So it's like, oh, I must have just been brainwashed.
Right. Exactly. That's what it has to be.
GJ, yeah. Get out of here.
I know. And then I heard some people called him John, too, so I don't...
What's his name?
I don't know. He went by a lot of different names, I think.
Yes.
Exactly. Okay, I was like, I just fucking... We just talked about it.
Know what I'm saying?
I know. I missed the telepathy on that one. Hey, you guys, have you ever wondered about the backstory, like why we call our dad Miss KB? We have gotten this question so many times, we thought we'd release a little freebie for you.
So we recorded a Patreon exclusive Q&A last year, and be warned, we were outside and there was some wind, where we answered this question, and we want y'all to have the answer even if you're not a patron.
Yeah, so be sure to head to killerqueens.link/MissKB, MISSKB, and grab the audio.
And don't forget, if you want the full Q&A or access to our entire catalog of over 450 patron-only episodes with all our regular episodes ad-free, you can join the Patreon for less than 1.5 Starbucks drinks per month.
I mean, that's a good deal.
It's a steal.
It is. It's a steal. You'll get 4 episodes per week from us, all ad-free, plus anything fun we do like Q&As or literally anything else. So definitely check it out.
And not every tier includes every episode?
Yeah, we do have different tiers, so just be sure everything's listed out there when you check it out. But in the meantime, be sure to grab your free audio about Miss KB and how he came to be called that at killerqueens.link/MissKB. Next, Schaefer found himself enrolling in Broward Community College in Fort Lauderdale. In college, he got okay grades. He was studying for a social studies major, but then he switched to getting a bachelor's in education. While attending the community college, he spent more time hunting in the Everglades than studying. At the time, he was in a relationship which felt more like therapy than love. He told his girlfriend about the urges he felt to kill women who aroused him.
That's bold to tell your girlfriend. Yeah.
But I mean, we've seen this in several cases, and even the case of the young girl that was killed by the 14-year-old boy, he was telling his girlfriend he wanted to stab people. And I mean, they're much younger. These are college kids, but still, like, it happens.
Oh, 100% happens.
You know? So just a note to anybody listening, if your significant other is telling you things like this, that is a problem. That is not them just telling you something that they haven't told anybody else, and it's just
a fantasy.
It could just be a fantasy, right? But it could not. Like, we've seen it turn into murder. So.
And the fact that they even have enough confidence and courage to say it out loud, I think really says something about where their mind is with it.
Right. Yeah. You said the quiet part out loud.
Yeah.
Like, yeah. He mentioned a neighbor who he had been seeing change through her window, which we talked about, but he also mentioned another who was sunbathing in the privacy of her own backyard.
Oh my gosh.
Which is also, yeah, in case you're wondering, super slutty, according to GJ Schaefer. I don't know if she had a privacy fence or what. I'm sure she did.
Right.
But
it's like, oh my gosh, she's sunbathing where I can totally see her if I get a ladder and binoculars. That's ridiculous.
And hide in a bush. Yeah. Yeah, exactly. Eventually, his girlfriend broke up with him, which led him to stalking her as she dated other men. But eventually, he moved on from her. If you ask him, this was an amicable breakup because she went to another college. They'd been going steady for over a year. But you can't go steady when you live on opposite sides of the state. So they had to break up. She didn't want to. He didn't want to. It was just a fact of life. Okay.
Okay. I totally believe that.
Yeah, that's exactly what happened. While attending community college, Schaefer actually traveled with a musical troupe, Sing Out 66. The troupe was a fun traveling group of super patriotic moral rearment members, which is like a group. You can look into it. interesting stuff. Fun fact, though, actress Glenn Close was a member of the chorus in Sing Out 66.
Wow. Sing Out 66 is, I mean, I don't know what a better name would be, but I feel like it's lacking something. I don't love that name.
I really don't.
Sing out.
It could mean something.
66.
Yeah. Yeah, I don't know.
Maybe Matchbox 40.
Oh, Driving 30?
Driving 30.
There you go. In the group, a woman named Martha Fogg from Boston caught Schaefer's eye. They dated the summer while they toured and prepared for a European tour. This is like,
it's a big fucking group.
I know. But Schaefer got measles and he had to miss the tour, and then he lost touch with Martha.
Boo freaking who? I mean, good for Martha.
Yeah. I thought he married
her. He does. Keep going.
Oh, okay. Wow. There's a lot of women. Oh, yeah. Okay. He also confessed his homicidal urges to a creative writing teacher, and the teacher referred him to one of the college's counselors.
I guess that's all they could do.
Except, yeah. But no, he didn't. He was just writing, so jot that down. Yeah. Okay. Schaefer told the counselor he wanted to join the army because, quote, he would like to kill things. He said that he would shoot cows on local farms, which escalated to him beheading livestock with a machete and then performing sex acts with their carcasses.
Why? To all of the above.
I have a headache from all of the, like, this happened, then this happened, then this happened, and the clear escalation, the amount of people that he told these were urges to. And then he gets busted for murder, and he's like, that was all just like jokes. That was all just like, I'm a creative writer. I'm so good at creative writing. Those are just obviously short stories. I'm a fiction writer. What the fuck?
That is, it's such an interesting excuse, or, you know, like, and it happens. This is not the first time somebody said that. Yeah,
exactly. Like,
it's joking.
Hip to your game. Yeah. After his sophomore year, he applied to Florida Atlantic University and was accepted on scholarship to pursue his teaching certification. But His grades were too low to support a student deferment, and he was told to report for an Army physical, which would have led to him serving during the Vietnam War. Before his physical, though, he left a note in his dorm saying he was going to kill himself, and he ran. His roommate found the note, searched for him, and found him in a local shooting range that they frequented. Schaefer admitted that he wrote the note to help him get out of having to go.
So you didn't want to join the Army. I mean, didn't he just say to his counselor that he wanted to join the Army?
But also he didn't want to.
Okay, gotcha.
But also he did.
I mean, I don't think that that's a good reason to join the military is because you want to fuck shit up. But
no,
it's also like, but you just said you wanted to, and now you're doing everything right, in your little power to do it or to not do it. Excuse me.
Exactly. He wants to kill things, but he doesn't want to go to war.
Right.
So do you think you get to kill things during peacetime?
Right. I don't think that you're killing people during boot camp.
Yeah. What does he think the Army is like, where you just get to go in and they're like, shoot anybody you want to? It's free game.
I guess. Yeah.
Like, okay. He was referred to have emergency psychiatric testing, which found no suicidal urges, but did find that his, quote, psychological disorganization is severe and his frustration level low. He did end up receiving a Y-1 deferment for, quote, mental, moral, or physical reasons. And with that, he dodged the draft and he did not go to war.
He dodged the draft. And
I was worried that you would hear that, yeah. I almost said it like giraffe, but fast. Draft.
You do want to dodge the giraffe too, I think, though.
That could just crush you, I think.
I think so too. Plus their necks. Yeah. They do a lot of the whipping each other with their necks stuff.
Snap you like a twig.
Yes. Snap you like a chicken.
Yep. Mm-hmm. Around the same time, his parents' marriage finally fell apart after his father's decades of drinking, abuse, and extramarital affairs. But if you ask him again in the 80s, everything was fine. They divorced, and Schaefer reacted by quitting his construction job and going to Michigan on a hunting trip. Then he comes back to Florida with Martha Fogg from Sing Out 66. They announce they're engaged. They get married in December of 1968. This did not last long at all. They ended up divorcing in May of 1970 due to his constant demands for sex and spending all of his free time hunting. And Martha cited extreme cruelty as the reason for their split. So we already know that he associates sex with pain.
Mm-hmm.
And they get married in 1968, right? It's not illegal to rape your wife until the 90s.
Right.
So he finds a legal way to live out his sexual fantasies of causing pain to other people because he's got a wife and she has to.
Right. Yeah. And thank God she got out of it when she did, but.
Absolutely.
In August of 1969, Lee Bonadies, a neighbor from Schaefer's childhood, married her husband, Charles. Their marriage was rocky from the start with frequent fights and arguments. And one thing they fought about was the fact that Lee was interested in taking a job from her childhood neighbor, Gerard Schaefer. She told her husband that Schaefer had offered her a position with the CIA that paid $20,000. And that's in 69. So that's like a shitload of money in today's standards, by today's standards. Mm-hmm. So on September 8th, Charles came home to a note that said that Lee had gone to Miami. Her car was later found in a parking lot in Fort Lauderdale. And Lee's brother reached out to Schaefer, who told him that she had asked him for a ride to the airport because she was leaving her husband. He claimed that she was going to Cincinnati, but she never called him back with a departure time for her flight, so he assumed that she changed her mind. Now, exactly what happened to Lee remains unknown, but we do know that Schaefer was involved somehow, but put a pin in that because we're going to come back to it later. Schaefer began a student teaching internship at Plantation High School in Plantation, Florida on September 23rd, 1969, and was fired by November 7th.
Do they not? I mean, I know they do now, but did they not do any kind of like background check, psychological evaluation on people? Because he's already had emergency psychological or psychiatric testing at least once that we know of by this point.
Right. I don't know.
And he's already reported homicidal urges mm-hmm. to like his creative writing teacher. And like that stuff is documented. You know what I mean?
Oh, for sure. Yes. And I would think that
he does not need to be around.
No. Children at all.
Anybody. No. But yeah. Children. Yeah.
They cited his refusal to accept advice from his supervisors, as well as constantly trying to impose his personal beliefs upon the students as reasons for his dismissal. The school had received several complaints from parents regarding Schaefer, and after he was fired, he tried to apply for a teaching position at a high school in Boca Raton, but he was denied the job. Carmen Marie Halleck was a 22-year-old cocktail waitress who lived in Broward County. She met with her sister-in-law on December 18, 1969 for lunch and was excited about a date that she had planned for that evening. She said that she was meeting a teacher who had offered her a job doing, quote, some kind of undercover work for the government. She said that the job would involve international travel and lots of money. Marie missed work the next day, and by Christmas Day, her family had not heard from her. They used a spare key to check her apartment, and they found her dog locked up, unfed, which is very, very out of character for her, and the bathtub was full of water, as if she had filled it up to take a bath and then suddenly left. They filed a report, and Marie's car was found in a parking lot a few days later. Her body has never been recovered, but again, we do know that Schaefer was involved. Except for, no, he wasn't, because there's no evidence to support that, according to Schaefer. But more on that later.
So please do jot that
down. About 4 months after he was fired from Plantation High School, he got another teaching internship with Stranahan High School in Fort Lauderdale. He started on April 2nd, 1970, and by all accounts and reports, he was absolutely shit at this job. Just awful. His superiors noted that he was extremely arrogant and that he seemed to have very little knowledge of geography, the subject he was teaching. 7 weeks after he started teaching, he was informed by the principal that the school was withdrawing the internship and he was being terminated, and that ended his career teaching. After being fired this time, he decided he needed a little vacay, so he vacationed for about a month around Europe and North Africa before returning home. Upon his return, he didn't work for a while and pretty much just sat around thinking about all the failures about, you know, joining the priesthood. That didn't work out. He failed as a teacher. And as time marched on, like Tracy Lawrence always said, Schaefer found himself, quote, convinced that indecent women and that indecent women and prostitutes should be destroyed for the welfare of society. If I had a nickel for every serial killer that thought that sex workers needed to be eradicated, I would have like a dollar.
Mm-hmm. And yet also frequented their services. Yeah,
so, but that's different. It's not the same. So, ugh. In October of 1970, Schaefer was still attending FAU and was in need of tuition money. So he took a job as a security guard for Florida Power and Light. While there, he met Teresa Dean, who worked as a secretary. They started dating and got married shortly after Schaefer graduated from FAU in August of 1971 with a bachelor in geography. How are you so bad at geography, but you got a bachelor's in geography? Did you not pay attention?
Apparently the... Yeah.
Yeah. By this point, he had pretty much been blacklisted when it came to getting his teaching certificate, so his degree really did him no good. But he had already chosen a new line of work. He felt like he was unable to, quote, do the right thing as a priest or as a teacher, so the only logical next step was to become a cop. In September of 1971, he got a job with the Wilton Manors Police Department. They sent him to the police academy at Broward Community College, where he had previously attended. He completed the police academy in December of 1971 and began his 6-month probationary period with the police department. 3 weeks into his probation period, Belinda Hutches, who was 22, went missing. She was a cocktail waitress and also did sex work to earn money. In January of 72, her husband and 2-year-old daughter watched as she climbed into a blue Datsun with an unknown man behind the wheel. She vanished and was never heard from again. But once again, we know that Schaefer was involved in her disappearance. Chief Bernard Scott said that Schaefer was as poorly suited for police work as he was for the classroom. This guy cannot do anything right. He used poor judgment and did lots of dumb things. Chief Scott said that it didn't take long for him to decide that he didn't want Gerard Schaefer around. He was planning to fire him, but Schaefer unexpectedly got a commendation for a drug bust he participated in. This saved his job briefly. His fellow officer said that Schaefer was, quote, badge happy, and he was known for giving out traffic tickets at an extremely high rate. He frequently pulled over young women and asked them out on dates. Why? And also, you're with...
Also, he's married.
Yeah. Oh.
Or with Teresa.
Yeah. Like, hello, you have a significant other. I would call that, if by his standards, that's a little bit more than a slut.
Yeah. And even, okay, I can't, because in his interview, he talked about the fact that when he's with somebody, that's a commitment. If you're sleeping with somebody, that's a commitment. He views that, like, if he's romantically involved with somebody, that's a thing. That's a commitment. You don't do that with other people. But all these other sluts he was with, his words,
yeah,
didn't feel the same way. He was a romantic, but he was with these women who needed somebody who could just let them go do what they were going to do. But he wanted the commitment and the fidelity.
You sure about that, JG?
Okay.
JJ, I keep saying JG, it's JJ. I don't give a shit. I don't care to get his name right.
Who cares?
Exactly. Yeah. Chief Scott was going to fire Schaefer on March 16th, 72, before he got his commendation. Then about a month later, he called Schaefer into his office for a, quote, come to Jesus talk. He told him that after all of the BS and dumb mistakes, he was going to fire him. Schaefer begged for another chance. He's like, you know, big crocodile tears. Please, 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 please don't fire me. And Scott gave him one last chance. The next day, Scott found out that Schaefer had applied for a job with the Broward County Sheriff's Office and fired him on the spot.
I mean, does he think they don't talk?
Yes, he does. Apparently. Schaefer didn't get the job with Broward County, though, because he failed to pass their psychological exam. He then applied to different local departments all over the area, which sent Sheriff Scott's phone into overtime, fielding all of the questions. And he said that he told everyone that, quote, I would put on a uniform and walk the streets myself before I would have him back. In June of 72, Schaefer was hired by Sheriff Richard Crowder in Martin County, Florida. He came with a glowing recommendation letter from Sheriff Scott, which Sheriff Crowder later learned was completely forged. So, I guess he can do one thing right, and that is forge documents from his former boss. So,
right. Well, he's basically a professional writer.
Oh, that's true. So, I forgot about that. Yeah.
You know, this is just like another creative writing. It wasn't a forgery. Please don't charge him with it. It was just creative writing, just to see.
Yes. Right. Exactly.
So, Schaefer took his job seriously. Like before, he was known to give out traffic citations like they were water in the desert. And you can just, if you watch even 5 minutes of that interview with him, you can see that that's the kind of guy he would be, right? He's just like that. Like, if he was ever a hall monitor in school, like, so help me. Like, it just, you know. On the afternoon of July 21st, 1972, he encountered two teenage girls, Nancy Trotter and Paula Wells, who were hitchhiking. He was on duty. He was in his patrol car, and he stopped to talk with them. And he said he warned them of the dangers of hitching and offered to give them a ride to their destination. Once there, he learned that neither girl was from Florida, so he offered to, like, give them a tour of the area. I'll show you around Jensen Beach, because they were planning to go there the next day. So he's like, I'll show you all the sites, all that kind of stuff. So they agreed. They felt safe. This is a police officer. Mm-hmm. And he's in his car. It's not like he's a random guy being like, I'm a cop, trust me. He's obviously a cop. So they meet with him the next morning at 9:15. So Schaefer gets there that morning in the meeting spot. This time he's in plain clothes and just his personal car, which he tells them because they're like, okay.
Why?
This feels maybe not, yeah, not. Not good. And he's like, guys, I'm undercover right now. So that's why. And I don't want to give away my, you know, identity, I guess. Like, I don't want to give myself away. So I have to drive my car and I'm just in regular clothes. Don't worry about it. Everything's fine. They're like,
oh, okay.
I mean, I guess that makes sense. Like, okay. So they start driving to where they're supposed to be going. And then he turns and goes somewhere different. And he tells them, there's a reason for this, okay? I'm going to show you this old Spanish fort that was in the area. And while he's driving them, he's lecturing them about accepting rides from strangers and the dangers associated with it, including being sold into, quote, white slavery.
Hmm.
Okay. So they drive further into the rural and remote area. He keeps getting more and more intense with his lecture, and then he stops. He handcuffs and gags both girls before taking one to a tree close to the nearby Indian River. He tied her legs to the trunk below her knees. He puts a noose around her neck. He ties that to the branches above. And she was standing on roots on the ground to try to still breathe, because if she's not standing on those, she can't breathe. So she's trying to just keep herself up high enough, essentially. Right. He then gets the second girl, takes her to another nearby tree, ties her up in a similar way. And then he tells both girls that they're about to be raped and murdered. And then he gets an urgent call on his radio telling him he has to go to the police station. There's some kind of situation that he has to respond to. So he says, y'all don't even try to run. I'm not even going that far. I'm going down the road to talk to the men that I'm going to sell you to. BRB. Don't you go anywhere.
TTYL.
So about 2 hours later, he returns to the area and he discovers they've escaped. So he goes home. Like, what do you do? I mean, like,
yeah.
Uh-oh.
And then you just go home? Yeah. So he does call Sheriff Crowder and he says, I've done something very foolish. You're going to be mad at me. So he explains to the sheriff that he saw these girls hitchhiking, which he knew was very dangerous for them and wanted to teach them a lesson. But he, quote, overdid the job. So he tells Sheriff Crowder that he had abandoned them in the area by the Indian River. Sheriff Crowder and a lieutenant set out on the highway toward the area. And once they get kind of close by, they see a young woman in a river near the road. She was doing like a flutter kick to get through the water. And then once on the shore, she was waving around to try to get their attention. They removed the gag from her mouth and she said her name was Nancy. Her friend is still out in the woods. And they're like, actually, your friend has been picked up about 45 minutes before this. She's already at the police station. So they take Nancy to the police station and she and Paula tell them everything that happened. They said, you know, they told them how they escaped by carefully moving against their restraints, loosening their gags with their teeth while maintaining their balance on the tree roots, remember, to keep from hanging themselves. They gave a description of their captor and identified Schaefer as the man who took them. And Schaefer, of course, said, oh my God, you got, I was teaching them a lesson. Anybody could have picked them up and they would have been in a ditch. I did them a favor.
Right.
And he even said, nothing sexual happened. They didn't get raped. They're fine.
Yeah, but are they dead, though?
But did they die? Exactly. So I was just teaching them a lesson. Thankfully, none of these officers believed a word he said. Because I could see a world where other police officers are like, well, you know, but did they die, though? But Sheriff Crowder was like, not fucking having it. So Crowder ordered his officers to file charges of false imprisonment and aggravated assault. And about 2 weeks after his arrest, Schaefer made bail and he was released. He went back home and his wife and family did not notice any change in his behavior or demeanor. They believed his claim that he was just trying to teach them the dangers of hitchhiking. And again, he is a talker.
Yeah.
So I'm sure Teresa was like, oh my God, okay, fine. You didn't like whatever. And I'm sure he didn't tell her all the
details.
Of
course he didn't.
Like they were hung, you know, by the neck with a noose. And had they stepped off, they would have hung themselves.
Right.
You know, like all that. And he was free until his scheduled trial was to take place in November of 1972.
Now, listen, I think that as a law enforcement officer, you probably would. It would be great if you could teach people like in a classroom or go to do some sort of, you know, in a gym, public speaking and engagement where you're teaching somebody,
sure,
telling them about the dangers of hitchhiking. That's great. Great. You, sir, are the danger of hitchhiking. You are, in fact, the danger.
I mean, it literally is just incredible that they survived that, because had in that moment he not gotten that call.
Exactly. Yeah. Who knows what, well, I know what would have happened, but ugh. On September 27th, 1972, while out on bail for his trial, Schaefer abducted Susan Place, who was 17, and Georgia Jessup, who was 16. The three had met at an adult education center in Fort Lauderdale, and he told them that his name was Jerry Shepherd. He didn't really go too far off of Gerard Schaefer.
Mm-mm. He's like, J and sh. But just enough to, it's like when the guy from What We Do in the Shadows had the, what, tooth?
Oh, yes!
And he's totally unrecognizable.
Tony, God, what was his name? Tony Daytona? Something Daytona.
Yes, yes.
And he wore jeans, like, and put the toothpick, and he's,
yes,
like,
yes, jeans and the toothpick, and everybody's like,
who the hell are you? Yeah.
At all. Yeah, like, Jerry Shepherd, okay.
Well, it's also Gene Parmesan. All he does is, like, put on a wig, and it's like, mm-hmm, ah, it's Gene!
Gene Parmesan?
It's Gene! Oh my gosh! But, yeah, so now he's Jerry Shepherd, and he's from Colorado. He was going to return after a brief vacay in Mexico. And on the day they went missing, Susan's mom arrived home to find Susan straightening her hair while Georgia was in the living room. Or straightening her room. I'm so sorry. It's straightening her hair.
Comes naturally.
I don't know. Yeah, I'm sorry about that. Straightening her room. They introduced her to Schaefer, who she noted was just strange and a bit older than them. Susan told her mom that the three of them were going to go to the beach just to hang out and play guitar. She was suspicious, and Jerry, quote unquote, assured her that his intentions were nothing but noble. Even with his reassurance, she jotted down the license plate in a description of the 1969 Datsun that they drove off in. Smart cookie. Susan's mother had suspected that her daughter was trying to run away, and Susan told her that she was just going to be gone for just a little while, but would make sure to call her and stay in contact. They left Susan's house at 8:45 p.m. 4 days later, she contacted Georgia's mom, and she said that Georgia had run away on the 27th, the same day that Susan went missing. Georgia's mom confirmed that she hadn't heard from either girl since that day. They went to the police and reported both girls missing. Susan's mom gave them the information she jotted down about the car and the license plate number, as well as a physical description of Jerry. They traced the registration from the license plate she provided, which led to a completely different vehicle in St. Petersburg, who owner didn't remotely resemble Jerry Shepherd. The man also had a firm alibi for the dates that the girls vanished, and there was a Jerry Shepherd with a registered address in Fort Lauderdale, but he was also eliminated as a suspect by the police, and the girls' disappearance quickly turned into a cold case. Schaefer went to court for the abduction of Nancy Trotter and Paula Wells in December of 72. Upon advice from his lawyer, he took a plea bargain and pled guilty to one charge of aggravated assault. I am beyond pissed because he was only given a year in prison with the possibility of parole in 6 months and 3 years of probation. What he did to these women, or these girls, because they were so young, my gosh, but what he did to them, that was murder with a whoopsie.
100%. Like, that's attempted murder.
Yes, 100%.
And had they not maneuvered in just the right way when they were trying to escape, they would have died.
Lucky.
They would have been hung.
Well, and I think, I mean, you can say whatever you want about, I think that that was luck, but also a God thing, because it's like, you know, by all accounts, they probably should not have made it through that, but they both did. Thank God in heaven.
Yeah. Yeah. And then we're just going to say, well, let's reduce it down to aggravated assault. We'll give him a year.
I know. And like, okay, well, I mean, let's give him another chance to see if he can pull it off next time.
I mean, because if they survived this, so they're telling you exactly what he told them. He told them, I'm going to rape you and murder you.
Yes.
Like, he described in detail what he was going to do to them just so he could see the terror in their faces.
Mm-hmm. That is so Night Stalker-y. Blech.
Mm-hmm. And so we have that information. We know exactly what he said because they were there and they're never going to forget that. Mm-hmm. but we're going to reduce that down to aggravated assault and we remove the false imprisonment?
That is some bullshit. When his sentence was given on December 22nd, the judge said, quote, "It is beyond the court's imagination to conceive how you were such a foolish and astronomic jackass as you were in this case."
Did this judge believe that he was just trying to teach them a lesson?
I don't know.
How foolish, what a jackass you were. Not evil, not calculated, not preying on the vulnerable, none of that. Just
what a jackass.
Man, what a dummy. I mean, you did something just so silly and foolish.
Yeah. I mean, obviously, I guess. I don't know. The court allowed Schaefer to start serving his sentence after the holidays, and he began serving on January 15th, 1973. He can't miss Christmas. That would be rude.
Exactly.
Meanwhile,
not fair to him.
Yeah, the girls, they started their sentence the day that it fucking happened. So,
yep.
In March of 73, Susan's mother was going through Susan's room and belongings when she found a letter that she had saved that was written by whoever the hell Jerry is. She went to the return address and spoke with the building manager. The manager informed her that Jerry Shepherd had never been there, but the property had been registered to a Gerard Schaefer, who had just been sent to prison for abducting two girls. Susan's mom is a fucking private investigator.
Mm-hmm. Also, Gerard, you were a police officer. I know he didn't investigate like homicides and stuff like that, but like, you're going to write a letter.
Yes.
To the person who you later abduct and murder.
Yes.
And you're going to put you gave her a fake name, but you gave her your real fucking address. You didn't think it was possible that that might still be there?
See, like, and that's where the foolishness comes in.
Well, that is foolish. What a jackass.
It's just silly.
Silly jackass. Yes. Yeah, just goofy stuff, man.
As Susan's mom and her husband drove around the county, she had a realization. She thought that it was possible that the police had been looking the registration up in Pinellas County and not in Martin County. License plates from Martin County began with a 42, where Pinellas County was just a 4, then random numbers. Now, this was back in the time before, before computers, they couldn't really look up. They couldn't just go in and type something in and be like, where is this license plate?
Like each county had their own paper records. You'd have to go county by county.
And you would have to know probably which county you needed to begin in by the letter or by the numbers at the beginning, right?
Exactly.
So how investigators never thought of this is outrageous. I just don't understand because they should have been the ones to crack that case, but they didn't. She spoke with the police and they learned that the license plate was in fact registered to a Datsun in the name of Gerard Schaefer. Upon questioning, Schaefer denied even meeting the girls or their families. There's somebody right the F over there who knows you and saw you and says so. And he's like, I don't know. I've never met that woman in my entire life.
She's like, bitch, I talked to you. You told me that your intentions with my daughter were noble.
You came to my house.
Yeah. Yeah. You've been in my
house. I made Arnie Palmies.
Yeah. Gaslighting motherfucker. Also, he maintained while in prison that car was not registered to him. They made that.
God, I just.
Just in case you're wondering.
Wow. Does he believe it? Is he delusional? Is he a liar? Like, I just don't understand. But I mean, Susan's mom picked him out of a photo lineup. Like she knows who the fuck he is. So
mm-hmm. She knew him as Jerry Shepherd, but she fucking knew him.
Yes. She fucking knew him.
I mean, the afternoon of April 1st, some men were walking through a wooded area in Port St. Lucie, Florida. They were looking for aluminum cans that could be turned in for recycling. When they came upon the extremely decomposed remains of two people, they were in a grave that had unfortunately been ravaged by wildlife and just the general Florida elements at that point. The graves were a little over 200 feet from the nearest road and a little over 2 feet deep. A nearby tree had deep scratch marks on the base. One of the victims was completely nude and the other had tattered remains of blue jeans with a Roadrunner patch on them. A pile of clothing was found nearby with grass growing over it. The gravesite was 6 miles from where Nancy and Paula had been held captive prior to escaping. Both of the bodies had been bound and murdered. Their spinal cords were severed and several bones were completely severed with a knife or machete. They had been decapitated and their jaws sustained numerous fractures. It was later determined that Susan sustained a gunshot to her lower jaw from a .22 caliber pistol. Markings on the bark of a nearby tree indicated that they had been tied to it, and the initials GJ were also carved into the tree, along with several deep markings from a knife, machete, or axe, along with sections of torn clothing.
What a fucking idiot.
Mm-hmm. But there's no evidence against him.
No.
Not one shred of evidence against him. Don't you think there's other people who have the initials GJ? Don't you think that's possible?
Yeah.
I mean, other people live in Florida. What do you think?
Exactly. Exactly.
Oh my gosh. They were identified as Susan and Georgia via dental records, which, fun fact, Dr. Richard Suveron is the one who identified them. And ooh, we know Dr. Suveron as the man who first coined forensic odontology because he did Ted Bundy's bite mark and then later went on to help convict lots of other people using bite mark evidence that now he's like, oh, fuck, that guy was exonerated, huh?
Yeah. Oops. Oops. I guess that was junk science. I don't think he said that. I don't think that he would ever say that.
No, he still thinks it's, yeah, exactly. Yeah. But anyway, but that was him. So, and healed bone fractures. And when Schaefer was informed of the identification of the two bodies, he immediately requested a public defender. Due to the similarities between the gravesite and the abductions that Schaefer had performed earlier, search warrants were given in Broward and Martin counties for his home, his cars, and also his mother's home. The search warrant in Martin County covered Schaefer's home. Investigators recovered several knives and firearms from a utility shed. They found what they described as an extensively blood-stained pillowcase that had been washed several times, as well as two human teeth that were stored in a small plastic container in the master bedroom.
I think that's bad.
Schaefer's wife, Teresa, was found to be in possession of a purse that matched one that belonged to Georgia Jessup. And she told the investigators that GJ, good old GJ, had given it to her the previous November, and the girls were killed in September. So 2 months after these girls were killed, he gives her a purse as a gift.
Right.
I would throw up.
Uh-huh.
I'm sure she did.
I'm sure she did too. Yeah. A lot of, well, and that's, it's not uncommon or unheard of. I mean, yeah. Just gross.
Yeah. Schaefer's brother-in-law told police that after the discovery of the bodies in April, he told them that they should discard the purse because the police would try to use it to make up evidence against him at some point. Mm. The amount of times he uses the word in that interview that I watched, framed.
Yeah.
They frame me. I was framed. They frame me. They frame me. I'm framed. Like,
I watched enough of it to know that it's just him spouting off the same information, but different ways. And mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah. The search warrant in Broward County allowed investigators to search Schaefer's mother's home. And inside, they found countless stories that he'd written about various ways to kidnap, humiliate, rape, and murder women. They found around 300 pages worth of stories. Some included crude drawings that he'd made as well. Two of the stories included women named Belinda and Carmen, both names of women who had disappeared previously. Mm. What a coinky ding.
Yeah.
They also found guns and tons of ammunition, 13 hunting knives, ropes, and tons of softcore porn magazines, some of which, though, he altered to show the women as dead or hanging or having been shot.
Oh, God.
But that's all just for the research process of creative writing. Everybody knows that if you're going to write something like that, you have to
have some sort of visual aid.
Yeah, you need a visual aid. You need to get into the mind of the person, and you've got to write 300 pages worth of things acting like you have fantasies about dead women or killing women, altering porn magazines to make these women look dead or dying.
Or what about, keep going, because...
Yeah. They found Polaroids of women tied up and some of Schaefer tied up in women's garments with fecal matter smeared across his backside.
Ew.
Somebody had a penchant for human excrement and the smells and the, but from fear. He liked the fear part of it.
I think
that you would be in so much fear that you would urinate or that you would defecate. And he would encourage that. He would give women bottles of water to drink before he killed them so they would pee.
He is a literal disgust.
Yeah. Amoebas on fleas on
rats. Yes. Yeah. Oh, Greece again. Wow.
Oh. They found a gold jewelry box that contained jewelry, passports, and clothing of several young women.
No evidence, though. Get out of here with that.
He says that the jewelry they found was his sister's jewelry because they looked in his mother's house. So they found, he may have said his mom's too, but he said definitely his sister's jewelry is what they found.
Mm-hmm.
And they also found his brother's wife's jewelry or his brother's girlfriend's jewelry because they had lived at the house. So he's like, here they are rummaging through. And the search warrant is for items related to the two girls that were killed. But that's not what they found. They found stuff that they decided to make up was related to them. It had nothing to do with them, nothing to do with me. Of course they're going to find jewelry. Of course they're going to find clothing. Women had stuff there, but it wasn't my stuff and it wasn't their stuff. It was just other people's stuff. And so they said it was their stuff.
Now take what Torella just said and rework it a bunch of different ways to add up to probably, like she said, 4, 5, 6 hours of that. And that's what whoever the poor soul who interviewed him got, I guarantee
you. Oh my gosh. Yeah. It's just like, passports have names on them, you dumb motherfucker. Like, you could maybe say that if a victim's mom says, yeah, that was her necklace or that was her ring or her earrings or whatever, you could say.
Maybe not.
Maybe, maybe not. Like, maybe she had one that looked like that. If it's a locket with initials or something, that's obviously going to be a lot harder. But like, okay, sure. They made more than the one ring. They made more than the one whatever. Unless it's a custom made, you know, whatever. Passports, dude?
Yeah.
With several of the items, though, the police were unable to connect them to any missing girls, but they were able to link a few of the items. So one gold locket was inscribed with the name Lee. It belonged to Lee Bonadies, remember Schaefer's former neighbor who disappeared. I could be wrong, but I swear that's the name of the girl he said was the one who would strip tease in the window.
Okay, yeah. I mean, it's just, it's bizarre that it's a former neighbor and he had so much disdain for these, whoever was the neighbor.
Worthy of contempt, exactly. They discovered a passport that was linked to a missing woman and a driver's license belonging to another. They recovered teeth and sections of bone that were later linked to at least 8 different victims.
And you cannot, like, how do you explain that?
He does.
They were planted.
Well, what he says is, I don't think they exist.
Oh, yeah.
They say that's... that they found that, but I haven't seen it.
So what?
I'm like, but I'm sure in court they presented it.
I'm sure they did.
I don't have the entire court record. But I feel positive that you can't just get up there and be like, well, I found her driver's license at his house.
And you just got to trust.
You have to show that as evidence. Like, that's going to be in evidence.
100%.
But he says he never saw any of it. It doesn't exist. They just made it all up.
Okay.
In May, investigators had enough evidence to link Schaefer to 9 murders or unsolved disappearances from 1969 to 1973. A newspaper published an article in which they linked him to as many as 28 different missing women. On May 18th, Schaefer was formally charged with the first-degree murder for killing Susan Place and Georgia Jessup. He was held without bond and sent to a state hospital for psychiatric examinations. They concluded that he was suffering from paranoia, psychosis, and acute sexual deviation, and that he viewed himself as, quote, an eliminator of women he deemed immoral. They also deemed him mentally competent to stand trial. Now, you could view it that way, that that's what they found. You could also view it the way it really happened, which is what JG says. JJ, whatever the fuck.
I know, right?
I think it's JG Wentworth that gets me. JG
yes.
Wentworth. I'm just like it rolls 877
cash now.
Exactly. He says that when he got there, the psychiatrist that was supposed to be examining him said, oh, hey, you're the guy that killed all those women. And he's like,
oh, yeah? Well, you want stories? I'll give you stories.
So he made it all up just to go along with because he knew they weren't going to believe him anyway. So he said, I was just telling him all kinds of stories I could think of. Anything I could think of, I was telling him. I'm making them tell him this, tell him that. I thought about this, thought about another thing. Blah, blah, blah. I mean, they literally had to like fade him out and bring him back in.
Yeah.
He would not shut up. Like, yeah. So the trial commenced on September 17th, 1973. The prosecution called several witnesses, including the men who discovered the bodies. Susan Place's mother testified and identified Schaefer as the man that was with the girls the day they disappeared. They had doctors testify and go through all the evidence found during the autopsies and about how they identified the remains. Nancy Trotter and Paula Wells testified about how Schaefer had abducted them, tied them up in the woods before they were able to escape. And they presented the tree limbs that the girls were hung from and showed the jury the deep gashes and markings that had been left from how long they were tied up. They also submitted Schaefer's own writings where he detailed how to properly execute a woman.
Jeez.
Now, I think this might be a good place to drop in just a little audio from that interview, because he actually does a small reading of one of his writings in which, which he says is fiction.
Mm-hmm.
It's all made up. Okay. And he likens his creative writing to that of Stephen King, and probably better.
Yeah, only really better.
Yeah. So let's listen in.
Let's see. This part deals with picking up a woman in a bar, I think. Okay. The woman is by this time very frightened. This is good because the more frightened she is, the greater the thrill for me. I tell her to strip, but I let her leave her underwear on. I tie her to a branch and gag her if she is too noisy while I go about the business at hand. And then I'm skipping to another part, so there's a break here. I arrange the rope and the noose, and I dress the woman in the white shroud, place the pillowcase over her head, and then, if I feel I could sit down and entertain her with a bit of my conversation, terrorize her. Give her my ideas on what she will look like while she's hanging there, fighting the rope that is slowly choking the life out of her. Make it as real as possible for her so that she is petrified with fear. Make her know that she is going to die.
I feel like J.G. Wentworth is, that's all I'm going to call him from now on, is the Miranda Lambert of writing, where he's like, we're just like you, only prettier.
Oh, yeah. Oh, my gosh. I love that song.
I know, me too. Song.
Yeah. He's like, I do this excellently. The defense tried to discredit the witnesses that testified for the prosecution. Of course, that's their job. They called a hunting friend of Schaefer's who said that when the two would go out, Schaefer always carried a bag similar to the one he'd given his wife. I'm no hunter. Do you often carry a purse for hunting?
It's a man's like,
let me
bag.
Get my hunting purse. Yeah.
My hunting purse.
Do you keep your
lipstick in
there? Ichiban lipstick for men in there?
Yes, exactly.
I guess. Yeah. I don't know. I'm like, really? You're going to, don't you need like a bigger bag for?
Well, haven't you seen Kate Spade's line of hunting bags?
Oh.
Did you not
is
see
it next
them?
To? Is it next to the apartment pants category?
Yes.
Exactly. They claim that the gravesite had been dug after Schaefer was already incarcerated. How? How do you, did you fucking carbon date that shit down to the day? I mean.
Yes, they did. Thank you for asking.
Like, you cannot look at a hole and say it was dug before or after.
One of my dogs happens to be a hole expert, I've learned. She might be able to tell you exactly when, but she's not much of a talker, so I don't know if she would be very beneficial. Official now that I say it, but the amount of holes that she's dug in her day, and she's got one working, she's working on one right now. And I'll tell you what, it's an impressive hole.
Okay. Well, maybe have her take a peek.
Yes.
And get back to us on her analysis.
Sure. Yeah.
I mean, I know you can identify remains and approximately how long they've been decomposing. And of course, so many different elements affect that. Is it in water? Is it outside of water? Is it hot outside? Is it cold outside? You know, like,
well, and yeah, the
how far down in the ground is it?
If they have, if they're out in the elements and they have any kind of insect activity, then that is a really good way to identify how long they've been there. But
yeah, but there, you can only do that within a certain amount of time, right? And so they were killed in September and he reports to prison in January. That's only a couple of months.
Right.
So I think today we'd have a better chance of tightening that window.
Right.
But in the 70s, I mean, I don't know, you know?
Yeah.
I don't know. They didn't have hardly anything to go on. That's the two things that they went with, basically. When both sides rested, the case was put in the hands of the jury, and they deliberated for 5 hours and 10 minutes before returning two guilty counts for first-degree murder charges. Schaefer continued to declare his innocence. He was given two concurrent life sentences. His lawyers filed appeals. He filed appeals. They were all denied. And he claims he's being railroaded by, quote, overzealous prosecutors, corrupt law enforcement officers, and his own defense attorney. So he says his defense attorney was railroading him. He thinks this is an elaborate plan by the prosecutors, law enforcement, and his attorney. And do you want to know why? So that his attorney could marry his wife, Teresa, which he did do.
Yeah, he did.
Teresa visited him however many weeks after he was serving his sentence to serve him divorce papers.
Mm-hmm.
And then he finds out that Teresa is actually has accepted a proposal from the defense attorney, Elton Schwartz. But I don't think that Elton Schwartz took your case as a public defender for the purpose of framing you for murder so that you would go to prison and he could marry your wife.
Right. Like, Elton Schwartz is definitely a Mr. Steal Your Girl, but I don't think that that was this elaborate plan like he thinks it is. Maybe Teresa just wanted the Schwartz to be with her.
Apparently.
May the Schwartz be with
you. I mean, he's so vain, he probably thinks this murder trial is about him. Like,
yeah.
What the fuck? When he was in prison, other inmates suspected that Schaefer was a snitch for his own personal gain. He ended up being placed in solitary confinement several times for different offenses, including mail offenses, trying to convince the public to send him women's underwear. He also wrote what was described as, quote, killer fiction. This was the title of the book of short stories that he wrote, which he later released. He described this as a genre that doesn't glorify violence, no, but one that enables the reader to see the acts of murder and necrophilia, but in a fictional way.
Sure.
But the investigators were like, you're absolutely just recreating your own murders for your own fantasy.
Yeah.
And whatever.
Duh.
After his life imprisonment, Schaefer was never brought up on any more charges related to any of the other murders or missing women. And, you know, he's got a life sentence. He's not going anywhere. I'm not sure how the family has felt about that. You know, on one hand, they don't have to relive everything through a trial. But I do know that there are some families who are like, but I want this person to serve justice for my loved one. Like, I want it to.
Well, sure. And know. I wonder if they wanted to maybe face him in court and tell him, like, that victim impact statement, you know, because right. That can be very, very healing and cathartic for the family.
Yeah.
I don't know, though.
Exactly.
And also his whole thing about, like, well, you know, that was just fiction. I didn't write any of that because I did any of it. Yeah, fucking right. Because so many serial killers or murderers in general, they want to relive their murders. And like Sam Little did it through his drawings. Mm-hmm. J.G. Wentworth did it through his short stories, which I'm sure were utter crap.
Absolutely. I remember in the one that he read in the interview, he said, I just hated this so much. He was like, possibly have coitus with it.
Oops,
he said coitus.
Oh.
Yuck. Don't do that.
I hate it.
Luckily, I'm just going to say this, luckily, on December 3rd, 1995, Schaefer was attacked in prison and stabbed over 40 times in the face, head, neck, and body. Not saying anybody should be stabbed this way. I'm just saying,
well,
we're rid of him. Okay.
Well, and also he got what was coming to him because, I mean, he got a taste of his own medicine and it was bitter.
It was bitter, wasn't it? His throat was slashed and his right eye was, quote, destroyed. He had several broken ribs. His body was discovered after a fellow inmate reported it to the guards. And it was reported that he was killed because of an argument he got in with another inmate over who was going to get the last cup of hot water one day, presumably to make coffee. Honestly, I can't believe he fucking lasted that long because he was so... I mean, I cannot imagine having to deal with his ass every day. I cannot imagine it. Like, he was ridiculous. Somebody posted a comment in the... because I watched that interview on YouTube and somebody was like, he was killed in 1995, but he continued to talk until 2004. Like, it was so funny. And that man got 53 years and 10 months added to his sentence. Some people think he was killed because he was an informant. Pretty much every other inmate hated him. They would throw excrement into his cell. I mean, he just was not liked. When she found out about his murder, Georgia Jessup's mother said, quote, I've always believed he was going to get this. I just wish it had been sooner rather than later. Schaefer claimed to have killed Nancy Leichner, 21, Pamela Nader, 20. They were last seen alive hiking around a recreation area of the Ocala National Forest. Originally, authorities believed they'd died by drowning while swimming, but that was later disproved. After his arrest, Schaefer confessed to their murders. Lee Bonadies, 24, was Schaefer's neighbor who disappeared after telling her husband about that job opportunity with the CIA. Schaefer claims she never returned a call to him regarding the time she needed a ride to the airport, but it's believed, you know, that he murdered her as well. Her skull was found on a construction site in Palm Beach County in 1978 with 3 bullet holes in it. Carmen Halleck, 22, disappeared after talking with her sister-in-law about a date she was going on that night with Schaefer, where they would discuss a government job he was offering. Why are you setting all this shit up ahead of time? But I guess it worked for him, though.
Well, I mean, who else did we cover? Why can't I think of his name? He did the same fucking thing. He was like, I need you.
Oh,
you.
Gosh.
For that job. And it's amazing. And I'm going to buy you all kinds of stuff. I'm going to pay for your new wardrobe, new this, new that, whatever.
The one who threw his own banquet party or whatever?
Yes.
Robertson, somebody? I forget his name.
Oh, sure. John Robertson.
Yeah. Yeah, like you're like these people can talk
John Robinson?
To people. Robin, maybe?
Yeah.
Yeah, maybe. Like when you say, I'm going to offer you a job, you're about to get this job that's going to change your life and it's going to be, you know, blah, 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 all this stuff. People are going to talk to their loved ones. Hey, I'm so excited about this. I'm going on a date with this guy and I'm going to get this job. And like somehow that never came back to bite him in the ass. I just don't.
John Wayne Gacy did it for forever.
Yeah, it's just very disappointing. She was wearing a black chiffon dress. One of the stories that Schaefer had written prior to his arrest was about the mutilation and hanging of a woman wearing a black chiffon dress. 2 of the teeth that were recovered at Schaefer's home were determined to be Carmen's, along with a gold shamrock pin that she wore. Schaefer wrote a letter to his girlfriend when he was in prison confessing to the murders of 2 young girls, Peggy Ron, 9, and Wendy Stevenson, 8. The authenticity of this confession has been questioned by several experts because the individual last known to have seen these girls alive had observed both girls still clad in their bathing suits in the company of a man whose physical description is way different than Schaefer's. Belinda Hutchins, 22, was a cocktail waitress who left with Schaefer in his blue Datsun. She was never seen again, and the police recovered an address book she was known to carry in Schaefer's home, and it contained the name Jerry Shepherd as an entry for Schaefer. And he says over and over and over in this interview, I tell the police, you bring me evidence that you can actually link me to any of this and I'll confess.
Right.
I'll plead guilty. But they've got nothing. They have nothing that connects me to any of these women.
Yes, okay. The fuck they do.
Deborah Lowe, 13, disappeared walking to school. Her books were discovered later in a trash can about a block from her home. While her body has never been found, Deborah's family strongly believes that Schaefer was responsible for her disappearance. He had worked with her father and previously visited the family's home. I mean, you... Bonnie Taylor, 20, was known to have been pulled over by Schaefer while he worked with the Wilton Manors police. She disappeared shortly after being pulled over by him and has never been found. Elizabeth Wilt, 22, was in Florida from Arkansas for the Republican National Convention. The last correspondence her family received was a letter saying she was going to return home soon. She disappeared and her body has never been recovered. And while there might not be any direct evidence linking Schaefer to her disappearance, it is suspected that she fell victim to him because he was active in her area or in that area at the time. Mary Alice Brisalina, 14, and Elsie Lena Farmer, 13, disappeared while hitchhiking to a restaurant. Their decapitated bodies were found by construction workers buried 600 feet apart in January of 1973. A distinctive gold chain and Madonna pin belonging to Brisalina were later found in Schaefer's jewelry box.
He's got a purse and a jewelry box.
Yes. And these are not just like very generic, like plain gold chains. Like these are things that are distinctive. Suzanne Gale Poole, 15. She was a Fort Lauderdale teenager reported missing by her family shortly before Christmas of 1972. Her partial skeletal remains were discovered on June 16, 1974, bound to a mangrove tree in the swampland area. The remains were identified in May 2022 via genetic genealogy. The circumstances of her disappearance and murder led authorities to believe that she may have been a victim of Schaefer, who had been temporarily freed from court one day before the estimated date of her disappearance. One day difference.
Mm-hmm.
Colette Marie Goodenough, 19, and Barbara Ann Wilcox, 19, were both native to Cedar Rapids, Iowa. The women disappeared while hitchhiking from Sioux City to Florida just days before Schaefer began serving his jail sentence for the abductions of Trotter and Wells. Personal property identified as belongings to both women was later recovered from Schaefer's home. Their bound bodies were discovered along a canal bank in St. Lucie County in January of 1977. Both victims were formally identified by dental records on January 8, 1978. There's no consensus for when or where Schaefer started killing. With his death in prison, we'll never know the actual number of victims who died at his hands. And like Henry Lee Lucas, Schaefer did very little to dissuade any speculation when it came to linking him to potential victims. He's always proclaimed his innocence publicly, but privately, he claimed to have killed as many as 30 plus women and girls. And these are in like letters that he wrote to his that one girlfriend who remember that he went steady with for a while and then whatever. Her name is Sandra London. And you might recognize her name because we talked about her in the Danny Rowling case. She's one of the women who started writing into him and became friends with him and was like trying to help. She kind of had a thing for serial killers. Like it started with GJ, because they had gone to school together, and then she kind of started moving on, and
that's so I don't know, bizarre. Wow.
Having some, yeah, whatever. But he would write to her, and he would talk about this, and you see how many of these are two girls,
yeah,
that disappeared at the same time. He referred to that as doing doubles, and he wrote this disgusting letter that talked about how when he would see two girls together, he would just get excited about everything these juicy creatures
to offer.
And that he would force them to, like, he'd tie both of them up, tell them he was going to rape them and murder them and all that kind of stuff. And then he would ask him, which one of you should go first? And he says they would throw each other under the bus so quickly about why their friend needs to be the first one to die, which I don't actually believe. And if that's true, I mean, it's just so sad. But he would talk about that he loved the smell of the excrement because they would urinate or defecate out of fear and like all this stuff. He writes all this stuff in letters and later he says, oh, we were just workshopping some shit for the fiction book. Like she's the one who helped him produce that or publish that book.
Gross. Ugh. But guys, yes, all of the gross. That is the case.
That's the case. We love you guys.
Yes, we sure do. And we hope to catch you on the next episode. Bye.
Bye. We'd love to hear your thoughts on this case. Connect with us on Instagram or Facebook to continue the conversation. Thanks for listening, and we will meet you back here next week.
Bye.
The theme song for the show is created and composed by Stephen Toby. You can find more of Stephen's work on SoundCloud. Our logo was created by Sloan Williams of Sophisticated Crayon. You can find more of her work on Etsy. Visit us at killerqueenspodcast.com for merch and other info about the show.